In the 2000 census, individuals were allowed to choose more than one racial category to depict themselves. 6.8 million Americans identified themselves as multiracial. It will be interesting to hear the conversations that develop, that spring out of this census finding. Our guests in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine are very much interested in intercultural families. Jesse Carroll Grierson and Lauren Smith are the authors of a very interesting book on intercultural families in the Midwest. It's titled Love in a Global Village. The book tells the stories of 15 families. It tells stories of courtship and the joys and difficulties of creating families where there are differences of race, ethnicity, language, religion, and culture. They join us this afternoon to tell us more about the families they profile in Love in a Global Village. Jesse Grierson joins us by telephone this afternoon. Hi, Jesse.
Hello.
Welcome.
Thank you.
And Lauren Smith is with us here in our Urbana studios. Lauren, good afternoon.
Hello.
This is the second book the two of you have done, if I'm not mistaken, on intercultural families. What led you to your interest in the topic?
Well, we both were together at the University of Iowa as in the poetry workshop, and we were friends and writers together for a long time. And we, at a certain point in our lives, we also found that we had parallel families or family plans. We were both either engaged to or married to men from other countries, and we didn't find much reading material on intercultural families. We've fictional material and then sociological prose, but not the kinds of portraits that we were especially hungry for. So we set out to put together the kind of book that we wanted to read with Swang, and then feel like we were done, and put together the collection of essays in Love in a Global Village.
Okay, so the first was Swaying. Jesse, how does this second book, Love in a Global Village, differ from the first, or is it a continuation?
Well, I think Swaying, which is the full title is Swaying, Essays on Intercultural Love, we were really just trying to find and collect some essays on the subject because there was this sort of dry sociological prose on the one hand and the beginnings of a very active multicultural fiction movement on the other, but there weren't any what we thought of as real-life love stories. So we did that collection. And we wanted to continue the conversation with Love in a Global Village by broadening the range of voices. We knew that not everyone would feel comfortable submitting their stories to a literary anthology. And in fact, I think some people didn't even know necessarily that they had stories to tell. So we felt that by inviting them to tell us their stories, we could maybe reach a broader range of people and also continue the conversation. We ourselves were starting to have families and have children around, and we wanted to see how other couples, how these families changed over time. We just wanted to talk to other people.
So you set out with presumably some questions, you know, about that would lead you to be able to tell a story of how people were putting their lives together and how they were dealing with differences and dealing with challenges and celebrating the differences.
Well, we certainly had lists of questions that we took to each interview, but most of the time the questions changed when we interviewed the people because their stories took over every time. People had very different ways of seeing what they were doing and had very different ways of talking about it and thinking about it. So our questions changed to reflect that. Also, our questions developed over time because we were still in the middle of thinking about these issues when we started to have children, and we, you know, this is was a long-term project, so two children were born while we were writing this book. And that changed the way that we asked questions considerably.
Yeah. And in the book, there are families or couples that are in different stages of life. At the beginning, in kind of an intermediary kind of a situation, and then later on. How did you find these folks, Jesse?
Well, you know, that's an interesting question because we found them through a variety of connections, through colleagues and friends and family. But sometimes there were just quirky things, like my own intercultural relatives were taking care of my daughters in a nearby park, and they saw another interesting-looking woman who was taking care of her intercultural granddaughter, and that's how we met Shirley Taraki, who we profile, who had a long marriage to a man from Afghanistan. And they heard her speaking a different language. They could tell that sounded something familiar to them, but not quite. And so that was how they, and they came home very excited because they knew I was working on this project and they had found a way to help me. So it was sometimes things like that. And a high school friend of mine emailed me a message from Ohio and told me about this wonderful professor that he had who turned out to be a German woman married to an African-American male and they had adopted a Chinese daughter. So that was how we met another couple in the book.
Yeah. Now, the families that you got to know that have children, how do they talk with their kids about racial and or ethnic identity? Is that a big issue?
Oh, yes. For most of the families, it certainly is a big issue. They had really different ways of talking to their children, though, and talking to each other. Some of the families really emphasized sort of the universal nature of humankind and emphasized individual choice and so on. Sometimes they were more self-conscious in weaving together the different strands of the two cultures that made up the couple. Oftentimes, in fact, they thought of themselves, though, as international, so that their children were likely to go abroad and not necessarily to the country that their foreign-born parent came from. They had international students coming to stay at their homes from all over the world. They ate food from all over the world and went to celebrations of different cultures, not just the two cultures, not just American culture or the other culture that made up their household. So
yeah, I think that was one of the real discoveries, that they didn't tend to think of themselves as a biracial or bicultural family so much as an international family and a very inclusive one, as Lauren's suggesting. So that was a really interesting discovery. And they just tended to be very open and interested, actively interested in other cultures.
Yeah, that wasn't always true. There were at least a couple of families that thought of themselves as American first, and there was one family that emphasized that they were an African family, an African-American woman married to a man from Ghana, and they really emphasized racial solidarity and their African identities. There were differences, but mostly, Jesse's right, there was a sense of being multicultural,
of being international.
Being international.
Of being UN, I guess.
Yeah.
And in all cases, they did talk about it. I think in that way they were a model for us as a country because they insisted on having these conversations, or they were required for the family, for everyone to be comfortable. So I think that was one of the things that we came away being very impressed with. And in that way, we do think of them as model neighbors, and you know, for the kinds of conversations that we really ought to be having in this country if we want to think of ourselves as multicultural without becoming homogenous, you know, then we do have to think about how we can preserve and celebrate individual cultural differences while creating a shared family culture or a shared community.
These folks that you got to know, that you met and interviewed, did they see themselves as unusual?
No, usually they didn't.
Yeah.
Usually
okay.
They didn't. And it was fun to draw them out because they oftentimes saw themselves as more unusual after having been asked.
Yeah, I think that's a good
lots of probing personal questions by nosy strangers.
How do they make decisions about, you know, what I would think would be really big issues? What language if there's more than one language in the home, what language to speak? How do they deal with differences of religion? What holidays to celebrate and how to celebrate?
You know, I think that you said earlier that the questions changed over time. You mentioned that, and that's really true. And I think for new couples who are, you know, in the moment of choosing one another, they're very focused on immediate questions like where to live and what language to speak and how to make a daily life, a daily menu together. And I think that almost seems to us like an age of infatuation where everything about the other culture is wonderful. But as you said, that over time, if, for example, you have children, then you start facing questions of religion and can we embrace two religions in this family? And the question of language becomes more pressing with children. It's very difficult to have someone speak fluent Mandarin in the middle of Iowa, though mm-hmm. people managed it. But, you know, there's sadness with that, too, because I think language becomes limited over time if there's only one parent speaking it to a child. And then questions about how to raise the children. Are they going to be independent Americans who challenge authority, or are they going to be interdependent Fijians who, you know, submit to authority? And so, and then even in the end of the book, some families are facing questions about where they should live the end of their life, maybe not in America, which doesn't necessarily respect age. But, you know, and there was one woman who really was adamant about not wanting to go into an American nursing home. She was going back to her own country before that happened. So I think, and Lauren, I don't know how you think about this, it seemed to me they were made on a very individual level, but there was always a consciousness that these couples brought to it. There was nothing ever assumed because they were from two different cultures. I think they realized that all of these aspects of their lives, there was nothing to be taken for granted. So in that way, they had an advantage of reflection and conversation about these decisions.
Mm-hmm. And living in the Midwest in small communities where, you know, differences are unusual, we're more homogenous in small towns, probably. It's my guess. But is racism an issue for these families, and how do they cope with that?
Well, yes, racism is a really big issue. And one of our most troubling discoveries was that it was a big issue for the majority of people that we talked to.
Especially those who had any African ancestry, that was true for.
That's right. But race came up in all of our conversations in which one person was not white, and we had set out intentionally to talk about intercultural rather than interracial issues, since in this culture we tend to fetishize race, and there's lots of discussion about interracial couples and interracial families. So we had decided that we were not going to talk about that, but we could not keep that out of the conversation. It was a really big issue for lots of people. That was one of our most troubling discoveries, was how important an issue that still is and how impossible it is to have a conversation like the one we wanted to have without talking about racism. But one of our happiest discoveries was that it was not particularly difficult for, it wasn't any more difficult for people to live in the Midwest, even in the most rural communities, than it was for them to live in more suburban or more
urban settings.
Yeah, it was. They were able to thrive even on dirt roads and in farming country.
I felt bad with the presumption that small town Midwesterners are bigoted people.
Actually, so. there was a spirited discussion about that to the contrary by many people who lived in just the setting that Lauren's describing, that in fact the intimate small-town setting was the most effective way to break down stereotypes because people really did get to know you at the neighborhood potluck in a way that they wouldn't necessarily in urban Chicago. And having lived in that particular setting, I can see why. You know, you don't walk up to a stranger and have a conversation about race or ethnicity as easily in that kind of a setting. So, some people objected to that idea, too, and we ended up feeling that the Midwest, the myth of the Midwest as a rural, homogenous environment was, in fact, a myth.
Yeah. I'm sorry to say that we're out of time. We got to stop our conversation at this point, but it's been a delight. Jesse Grierson and Lauren Smith, authors of Love in a Global Village, A Celebration of Intercultural Families in the Midwest. The book is published by the University of Iowa Press.